Writer Margaret Randall may be deported from the United States under the McCarran-Walter Act, which makes it possible to deny an immigrant permanent residence in the U.S. because of their political ideology. A broad coalition of feminists, writers, and civil liberties groups have come to her defense. The Immigration and Naturalization Service began deportation proceedings against her in 1986, charging that her writing advocated doctrines of world communism and went beyond ordinary dissent. The case is still in appeal. Margaret Randall was born in New York in 1936 and grew up in Albuquerque. In 1961, she left her circle of writers and artists and moved with her baby to Mexico. She spent the remainder of the decade there, married a Mexican, and became a Mexican citizen herself. But because of her involvement in the Mexican student movement of 1968, she had to go underground and flee the country. Randall spent the 1970s in Cuba and the first half of the 80s in Nicaragua. Over the years, she's worked as a midwife, edited a literary magazine, written and translated poetry, and written many books about the lives of women. These include Sandino's Daughters, Cuban Women Now, and Spirit of the People, Vietnamese Women, 2 years from the Geneva Accords. Randall's new book is The Shape of Red. Randall returned to the U.S. in 1984 and moved to Albuquerque, where her parents live. She's been teaching at universities and is currently the Hubert Humphrey Professor of International Affairs at McAllister College in St. Paul. I spoke with her from KSJN in St. Paul, and she told me why she wanted to come back to the U.S.
Everyone at some point in their life wants to come home, and this for me is home. I was born here 52 years ago in New York City. I grew up in New Mexico on the desert, and when I left and went to Latin America in 1961, I really never imagined that I would stay away for 23 years. It was just one of those things where one thing leads to another, and one country leads to another, and one experience to another, and so forth. So I always had in the back of my mind that there would be a time when I would feel that I needed to come home. And that time was the beginning of 1984.
Was there something that happened in 1984 that made that the right time?
Not one particular thing, but I think an accumulation of feelings, or feelings probably rather than events. I felt that it was the time to come home, approaching midlife, approaching a time in my life anyway when I've wanted to sort of examine the different threads that have made up my experience living so long in Latin America and being born and raised and living also for a great deal of time here, sort of pull those threads together and see what the cloth looks like. I also wanted to be close to my parents, who are in their 80s and are getting on, and I hadn't been close to them, physically close, geographically close, for many years. So there were those considerations. There was the feeling that what I wanted to do in my writing and my work could best be done from here, from this place. So those were some of the things that went into my decision.
When you came back to the United States, did you know that you could be deported?
No, I didn't. I knew that I was not considered by the U.S. government a citizen, and I knew that I would have to ask for residency, but I came in on a legal visa, and I assumed that the residency would be somewhat easy, perhaps. It didn't surprise me that, given the places that I've lived, I would be called in, they would ask questions, they would want to know why I lived in those places or what I did there. That part did not surprise me. The whole case as it has evolved certainly surprised me, and the denial of residency, especially on the grounds of my writings, surprised me a great deal and shocked me.
Are there things that you've written in the past that you feel have come back to haunt you? Anything that you're sorry that you said?
Well, much of what I've written in the past certainly has come back to haunt me, in the sense that this case is a First Amendment case. I am not sorry for anything I've said, and I don't believe that one should be put in the position of having to disclaim the opinions one's held. I'm a person who's in evolution. I'm a person who, for whom process is very important, and so I may not hold the exact same opinions at one moment in my life that I've held at other moments, but I think that that's simply a matter of the way we evolve. In general, I would stand behind what I've written and what I've said, and but particularly stand behind my right to have had those opinions, and to have whatever opinion. I think that freedom of expression, freedom of dissent, is really a sacred right that we all should have.
Do you feel that you have to be careful about what you say now?
I feel that that is the message that's being given to me. But part of my battle is a daily battle to resist that message. I think that in a case like mine, really, and especially if I lose, all that I'm left with is my dignity. And that is one thing that they can never take from you. So I daily sort of wake up and remind myself that no, there is no reason why I need bite my tongue or censor myself or not express myself in the way that I feel is appropriate at any given moment. And I think that I've been able to do that, to continue to express myself, to continue to be outspoken about the things that are important to me without feeling intimidated by this case.
You went to Mexico when you were in your 20s and became a Mexican citizen. Let's talk about why you left the United States for Mexico. You were living in New York in your early 20s, and you were part of a circle of bohemian artists and writers. Let's back up a little bit more. You were a single mother. You had a child without getting married, which was a very... this was intentional, I think.
That's right.
That you wanted a child, but you didn't want to be married.
That's right. That's correct.
And whereas a lot of women seem to be choosing this as an option now, it was virtually unheard of in the early 60s or late 50s when you decided to do this.
That's true, Terry. It was very unusual. And in fact, I don't think many people believed that it had been intentional. I was a single mother, as you say. I had my son, who's now 29. He was 10 months old when we decided to go to Mexico. And I think I went to Mexico essentially, as you say, I was living in New York. I was working with a group of artists and writers there. And I think I felt that at that particular point, suddenly I realized, well, one can be a writer anywhere. You don't need to live in New York City to be a writer. I had my child. I was finding it very difficult to support him and myself. There were very few support systems for single mothers at that time, if any, in New York City. And I went off to Mexico with my son, seeking more than anything else a way to spend more time with him. Somehow I thought there would be an opportunity to work and support the two of us and be together more in Mexico City, which in fact turned out to be true. And, you know, it was a sense of adventure, too, I think. I had been in Mexico the summer before. I was curious. I spoke Spanish, and that's what sort of led me there.
Well, in Mexico, you edited a literary magazine, worked as a midwife, and you also gave up your U.S. citizenship and became a Mexican citizen. Why did you become a citizen of Mexico?
In 1966, 67, I already had three children. By that time, I had married a Mexican poet with whom I edited the magazine. And he, at that point, didn't have a job. I had three small children. In fact, at that moment, they were all under the age of six. And I really needed a better job. I was the sole support of our family at that point. I took up Mexican citizenship, which was very easy to do, being married to a Mexican citizen, simply for economic reasons. The government has tried repeatedly to say that this was a political act on my part. It was not. I wouldn't have thought of making a political act of that type. My political opinions were very strong and very clear, and I didn't hesitate to voice them, but that's not something that I would have done as a political statement. I simply took out Mexican citizenship as a way of getting a better job.
Did you get a better job?
Well, I did for a while. It was not only did I get a better job, but I paid less taxes as a citizen. But then things began to fall apart rather rapidly. Soon after that, my marriage deteriorated. The Mexican student movement of 1968-69 came on the scene, And so the job didn't last that long.
Well, you ended up being a part of that student movement. In fact, you ended up having to go underground. What was your involvement that made it necessary for you to go underground?
It wasn't a leadership involvement of any kind. It was the involvement that literally tens of thousands of people in Mexico had at that point, support for the students, support for their demands. I did some translating, brigade work in terms of getting the word out. But in our magazine, in the literary magazine that we edited, the magazine also took the students' part, and that was, I think, a big thing at that time. Most of the magazines that did that in Mexico immediately folded because these subsidies that they were getting from the Mexican government were cut off. In our case, since ours was a bilingual magazine and we were able to call on financial support from the United States and other places as well, we didn't fold. And I think that that was something that was hard for the Mexican authorities to take.
When you ended up having to go underground, you had four children at the time, is that right?
That's right. I had four children.
You sent them to Cuba because it was just about impossible for you to live underground with them and keep them well-fed and comfortable. Where did you send them?
Well, I sent them in care of a friend. Actually, I tried to send them to the United States. I asked my mother if she would take them while we figured out what to do with our lives. By that time, I was no longer married to this Mexican poet. I was with someone else, an American poet, a North American poet. And my mother just didn't feel that she would be able to care for four children, which is understandable. The youngest at that point was 3 months old. And the opportunity arose to send the children to Cuba in care of friends, which is what we ended up doing. I had been in Cuba at that point twice, I believe. Yeah, twice. Once the year before and once the year before that, to meetings of poets and intellectuals. And so I had friends there. And the children went to Cuba, and then I followed several months later.
How did you get out of Mexico? You moved next to Cuba.
Well, I got...
This is a secret story.
A long story. It's a story that's too long for a 20-minute interview, but I managed to get out of Mexico finally and get to Cuba, yes.
And did you have to do this through some kind of underground mechanism?
Well, not technically underground, but yes, without papers, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. It was really in Cuba and in Mexico that you started to write about feminist issues. And I suppose that there's some irony in the fact that you became a feminist while living in cultures that, I guess, are in some ways very macho cultures. I don't know if you think that's an accurate appraisal. Maybe it's not.
No, I think you're right, Terry. I think it was an interesting situation for me. While I was still living in Mexico, and of course very much in touch with the United States, and I never lost touch, really. I came back from time to time to visit my family, to do lecture tours, reading tours, and I was very much in touch with the literature that was coming out, the materials that were coming out of different movements in the States. I began to read this feminist work and began to identify very strongly with some of it. And I think for many of us who are women my age, the feminist movement were essential in a whole reassessment of our own lives. I happened to be living, as you say, in Mexico and then in Cuba at the time. So it was logical for me to ask the questions, well, what does a Latin culture mean for women? What does socialism, in the case of Cuba, mean for women's lives? And so after doing that first book in Mexico, when I went to Cuba, my first project was to listen, essentially, to Cuban women and find out some of the answers to that question. What does socialism mean? What does a people's revolution mean for women's problems? Does it solve them? Does it not solve them? Does it solve some of them? And that was the beginning of a number of years, I would say until the into the present in different ways, in which I've been intensely involved with doing oral history with women, thinking and writing about women's issues, teaching women's studies courses, and so forth. And it's been a major part of my life.
Were you in your years in Cuba and in Nicaragua, two revolutionary countries, self-conscious about being a white middle-class woman from the United States?
I think I was more self-conscious about that when I lived in Mexico, because I think that North Americans, people from the United States who live in the so-called third world countries, are forced to a consciousness of our government's role in the world and the nature of our class and skin privilege. And in a country like Mexico, there's sort of nothing you can do about it but feel the guilt. Whereas in a country like Cuba or Nicaragua, where there is a chance for some kind of participation, where people do not look at you necessarily for your class or race or gender qualifications, but for what you're willing and able and interested in doing with them in the building of their society, it was easier in those countries.
Had you romanticized revolution before you actually lived in Cuba and Nicaragua?
Oh, I think everyone romanticizes revolution, even the people who are making revolutions. I think it's the easiest thing in the world to romanticize a revolution. And I think that as you live in these countries and you become familiar with the tremendous problems inherent in changing society, you become much less romantic and also much more in awe. With a greater admiration for the kinds of accomplishments that have been possible.
You once said that in Cuba you met a group of younger poets who grew up after the revolution, and they didn't need to make statements about the revolution's values. They were just born into it. And that made you realize that revolutionaries didn't have to write about tractors or raised fists. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, well, that's... you know, as a poet, as a literary person, I think that perhaps, especially a literary person growing up in this country at the time when I did, we were raised sort of on the art is beyond politics, art must be pure, you can't write about politics or about change, because if you do, you're writing propaganda. That kind of message was the message that we grew up with. And I think that what I learned in these countries throughout my life is that one can write about anything. What you write about is not nearly as important as how you write about it. And for art to be art, it must be well done. It must be well made. And it can be well made about anything or poorly made about anything.
One thing that I've noticed about people who support revolutions in other countries is that they seem sometimes afraid to deal with certain ambiguities or failures in those revolutionary societies, out of fear that if they say something about that, it will be used as ammunition by their enemies. And I wonder if you feel you've ever fallen into that yourself.
Yes, I do. I think that we all fall into that, and I think that it's a mistake. I think that it does a disservice to the revolutions that we love, and also a disservice to ourselves. I think it's an easy thing to fall into because the tremendous propaganda machine in this country does use that sort of thing. If they didn't use it against the revolutions that we care about, then we wouldn't have that fear. So I think it's important to say that. But I do think it's very important not to overlook, not to ignore the problems, the struggles, the contradictions that making a revolutionary change entails, and to be critical and to deal with them head on out of a caring for what's happening.
What were some of the contradictions that were difficult for you to come to terms with in either Nicaragua or Cuba?
Well, certainly in Cuba, I think one of the contradictions was the situation of women's role in society. And that was something that I was very involved with. Women had certainly come an enormous distance during the revolutionary years preceding my arrival in the country. By the time I got there, the revolution was 10 years old. But there were still many, many problems. And for a long time, it was almost taboo to talk about those problems, to really say there remains discrimination against women in Cuba. And I think that that was a difficult thing that many of us had to deal with. The Cubans themselves, around 1974, finally came to terms with that. And many of us came to terms with it through they're coming to terms with. And I think one of the things that foreigners often fall into, as well as what you've pointed out, is not wanting to be disrespectful of another people's process. I mean, after all, it's not your process. It's not your rhythm. And as an outsider, one sometimes feels that one shouldn't impose one's own values. But I think that that was an issue in Cuba. I think that the Cubans have made a lot of changes since then and have corrected some mistakes, and that that's important, and that that happens in all processes, because these revolutions are processes. They're not a sort of cut-and-dried events, as some people would have them. They're processes that are always in evolution, in change.
And the Nicaragua contradictions you faced there?
Let's see. In Nicaragua, well, I think that the greatest contradictions in Nicaragua are created by the war, the Contra War, just the terrible daily contradictions of trying to push a struggle forward against those odds. And, of course, Cuba lived with those odds, too, in many ways. I can't think at the moment of a particular issue in Cuba, in Nicaragua, that within the Sandinista struggle itself that seemed contradictory to me.
You wrote an oral history of women who fought in the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. Do you think that women's working in the military permanently changed their relationship with men in that country? Did it have lasting effects? And I guess what I'm wondering, too, is if male-female relationships were changed on a personal level as a result of the changes in work or in fighting?
Yes, I think so. They certainly say so. Although it's interesting that since the Sandinista victory in Nicaragua, when the Council of State voted whether the draft should be mandatory for women as well as men, after a tremendous struggle, a pretty excited and vociferous struggle on the floor of the Council of State, it was finally decided that it was voted that women would not be drafted into the army. But I think that working for change under those conditions, whether it's with a gun in your hand or not, working for political change, working militarily for political change or whatever, you're in a life and death situation. And I think women in life and death situations next to men gain a different relationship to those men than the one they've had before. And I think that's something that changes both the men and the women forever.
Right now, you have four children, and if I'm correct, they're living in four different countries?
That's right.
Cuba, Mexico, New York, and someplace in Europe.
Yes, my oldest son lives in Paris. I have a daughter in Cuba. I have a daughter in Mexico City. And I have a daughter in Amherst, Massachusetts.
How does it feel to be so far away from them?
Terrible. It feels terrible, and it's one of the greatest weights of this case. I cannot leave the country until my case is won or lost. At least while I'm on appeal, I would forfeit that appeal. And I not only have four children, I have 2.5 grandchildren. I have 2 grandchildren and another on the way. And that's a very painful thing for me.
Has it made you think about how far you were from your parents all the years that you were living in Latin America?
Absolutely. And while it's wonderful to be close to my parents again, it's something that we both take a great deal of pleasure from. We live next door to one another. It's very, very painful for me to be away, so far away from my children.
Did your parents support you, I don't mean financially, but just emotionally, during the many changes that you made in your life?
Absolutely. My parents are tremendously supportive. They have been throughout my life, and they are today. I think that during my immigration hearing in El Paso, the only time I ever broke down and cried in the 4 days that hearing lasted was when my mother was on the witness stand. She was absolutely extraordinary, as was my father. They are exceedingly supportive people. And one of the things that's quite unusual about them, I think, is that they are people who are capable of great change in spite of their age. They're always open to new ideas. They're quite wonderful, my parents.
I'm wondering if you feel that you're living in a state of limbo right now.
I do, often. I try to fight against that, Terry. I try to work and continue teaching, writing, doing my photography, reading, lecturing, as if this case was not a part of my life. But it is a part of my life, and of course it affects my future. It affects the future of my family, very much my parents, who I think feel the state of limbo perhaps even more than I do, or the anxiety of it, maybe because they don't have the resources to fight against it as I do. So that's something that I'm just continually struggling against, how to continue to do my work while living in this kind of uncertainty. And it's harder some days than it is other days.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. It's been wonderful.